Hi, everyone. This is Amanda from Praxis. On behalf of Praxis, Manavi, and the Office on Violence Against Women, I'd like to welcome all of you to the fifth keynote address of the Advocacy Learning Center. On this call, we have participants from all three of our participating class groups, so at this point, our numbers are at their maximum on our audio conferences. I want to welcome our Class C participants that we met with just a few weeks ago. We hope you had a good journey back from the retreat. We had a wonderful time together, and I hope now that you're all settled in back at home and in your programs. For Class B, it was wonderful to see all of you again at the Systems Change Institute in September. We hope that you're still holding on to some of the energy and inspiration we all shared at that event. And welcome onto the call. And for Class A, I suspect that for you all, the retreat in the Systems Change Institute must seem like a long time ago, but we all here at Praxis and Manavi still very much enjoy hearing your voices on the audio conferences. And just so you know, we have all your photographs up on our wall with all your faces smiling back at us every day, so we haven't forgotten you, even though you're our first class and it's a while since we've actually seen you in person. So we have a lot of us on this call today, but hopefully we'll have lots of chances still for participation. And even though we can't see each other, we are virtually linked by the technology, but also by the experiences that we've all had in our times together. Ellen, are you on the line? I think you just wanted to say
yes.
Hi to everybody.
Right. Yeah, I do. Hi, everyone. I just want to say to Class A and B that Class C just met, and they gave themselves a name. I was telling people we can't go on saying Class A, B, and C. We've got to come up with names. And so they're calling themselves Classy. So A and B, you better come up with something. You know, I was thinking we name ourselves after, you know, a woman that we admire or something. But Class C is now calling themselves Classy. And just so you know, Selena's song won the talent show, and the Italian opera came in about 10th place. So that's my report from the last retreat.
I think maybe we should have a talent show by audio conference for all three classes.
Yes, right.
We'll have
that
like
would
a
be
grand
great.
Winner, but it would have to be audio shows instead of video.
That would be great.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So as you all already know, or most of you already know, this course, the Advocacy Learning Center course, has several components. This event is part of our quarterly keynote lecture series, in which we invite prominent social activists and scholars to share their work and thinking with us. They're a space in which we hopefully get a chance to sort of expand our understanding of the issue of violence against women and oppression. And to that end, our keynote speaker today is Dr. Mary Hunt. She advocates and works on the complex and sometimes contentious area of religion. Religion is an extremely important part of women's lives, and yet it also generates much conflict and difficulty. It boosts women's power, and at the same time, it can disenfranchise them. It celebrates women, and it oppresses them at the same time. I'm sure Dr. Hunt is going to talk about all of this much more eloquently than I. Her advocacy on behalf of women remains at this crucial juncture and seeks to empower women and make space for their voices within the Christian faith. Dr. Hunt is a feminist theologian who's a co-founder and co-director of the Women's Alliance for Theology, Ethics, and Ritual. His acronym is very nicely WATER, and she's out of Silver Spring in Maryland. She's Catholic by faith and is active in the women church movement. She lectures and writes on theology and ethics, with particular attention to liberation issues. She's the author and editor of a few publications that we've given you information about in the publicity. And through her organization, she's created an international community of justice-seeking people who promote the use of feminist values to make religious and social change. So I'm going to hand it over to you now, Dr. Hunt. She will talk for, you'll have about 15 minutes of lecture time, and then we will open the lines up for questions. Now, to the participants out there, if I could sing this, I would, just to get your attention more, but basically, we really want you to ask questions and to participate in the call. We know there's a lot of you out there, and that we know that listening, you know, for a long period of time can be hard. We've strongly, strongly recommend that you get a pen and paper and you take some notes because it really helps in the listening process. In your note-taking, if you can just jot down any comments or any thoughts or any questions that you have as you listen to Dr. Hunt speak. And we want to stop several times in the call and give you an opportunity to ask questions. And your asking questions is what will generate a sense of us sort of thinking this through, thing through together and sharing our understanding of it. So please, please, please take some notes and make notes of questions and be ready when we provide the opportunity on the line to get right there into the question queue to take this opportunity to talk to Dr. Hunt about her work and her thinking and her experience. So I'm going to hand it over to you now, Mary.
Thanks so very much. Hi, this is Mary Hunt. I'm in Silver Spring, Maryland, and I am in my office, if you can imagine, in Silver Spring in downtown, that is a suburb of Washington, D.C. And I want to begin by thanking Shamita Dasgupta for inviting me to be part of this very exciting series. And I also want to thank in a special way Sandy Davidson for handling all the logistics and bringing me on board, and certainly thank you, Amanda, for chairing our session this afternoon. It sounds from your introduction as if these retreats are great fun, so I certainly will look forward to one of those someday. I'm very impressed by this innovative pedagogy in which you're engaged. It's really a teacher and an organizer's dream to have such a well-rounded curriculum to motivate people to do the important work that you're all doing to make social change and to end violence against women in our lifetime. And it looks to me from a quick skim at the curriculum that you're getting the tools to do just that. So I begin with my thanks not only to the organizers, but also my thanks to the participants. We in the larger society are very much in your debt as you go about your work. And I loved seeing your pictures on the website so that I have you in my mind and in my heart as we begin our work together. My topic, as you know, is spirituality and social change. And I know for some people, religion is one of those untouchable themes. You think it was kind of given at the beginning of time and religions don't change. But I'm living proof that religions are dynamic activities. They change like everything else in our society, and I hope to give you some insights into how I think that happens best and to encourage you to see the implications of religion in the work that you're doing for social change. I personally am deeply influenced by the work of someone some of you may know, the Reverend Dr. Marie Marshall Fortune of the Faith Trust Institute in Seattle. And I realize it's not my task today to deal with anti-violence work. That's what you do. But I have to mention Faith Trust at the outset because so much of the work in spirituality and social change that I'm involved in and many others of my colleagues, so much of that work finds connections to Marie Fortune's pioneering work now more than 30 years later when she began to try to tease out the relationship between religion and violence against women. And it's really a prototype of the kind of work that we're doing in other fields. And I think as I talk about the interreligious nature of our work, about what we expect of clergy and so forth, you'll see echoes of Marie Fortune's important work. If you don't know the Faith Trust Institute, I urge you to go to their website and take a good look. I think they're the premier resource for work in this area. My topic is spirituality and social change, a look at how advocacy work is done in a field similar to your own, but really focusing on the question of religion. So let me say that I am a Catholic feminist theologian. Now, for some people, that's a contradiction in terms. I wasn't named one of the cardinals today. The Vatican just named 24 new cardinals, and I'm sad to say I wasn't named. Well, maybe I'm happy to say I wasn't named as a cardinal. But I am a Catholic feminist theologian. I trained both at Harvard and Berkeley for the PhD in theology, and I worked through the MDiv program, which is the degree for ordination with the Jesuits. But at the end of the program, of course, as a Catholic woman, I couldn't be ordained. So you can imagine that even though that was some decades ago, it left me with the impression that religion was a place which needed some serious social change. And it, particularly in my own Catholic tradition, but I'm sure you can extrapolate to your own faith traditions as well, the very source of much of my own sense of value and meaning in the world is also a place and a location of some of the deepest dissonance and contradiction. So instead of becoming a Catholic priest, I had a PhD, so I decided to work abroad for a couple of years, and I spent some time teaching and working on human rights issues in Argentina during the dictatorship, and I can assure you that that honed my sense of the value of freedom and also the value of anti-violence and working for peaceful societies. And then when I came back to the States in 1983, I joined with Diane New, my partner, to develop an organization that we call WATER, as Amanda mentioned, the Women's Alliance for Theology, Ethics, and Ritual. And we founded WATER in 1983 because we wanted to bring feminist religious values to the service of social change. We realized that many people left, especially women, left their religious traditions because those traditions were racist, classist, sexist, heterosexist, and otherwise conflicted with their political sense of how they wanted to be in the world. For women, this is very tough, especially, and I speak out of the Christian tradition, but I know it's the case also for women in Judaism, for women in some native groups, for Buddhist and Hindu and pagan women, that the sources of our most deeply held values may be religious, but the institutions and the structures that carry those values often contradict them. I always say I can't buy love and justice at the grocery store, but I can begin to see it actualized in many ways in the world. And so religion is a place that, or a locus in society, if you will, where I've decided to put my energies. I've broken down my comments today into four areas of interest. The first is I want to talk about the centrality of religion and spirituality in many people's lives in our country. Secondly, I want to talk about the relationship between religion and other cultural influences, particularly the way in which religion is political in our society. Third, I want to talk about religious diversity. And finally, I want to invite you to think about what we can expect from religious professionals, especially as partners in the kind of important work that you're doing. So let me turn to the first question, the centrality of religion or spirituality. And I'll touch the first two questions, then we'll have a time for questions and discussion, and then I'll come back and talk about the other two areas of interest. So first, the centrality of religion, and second, the relationship between religion and other cultural influences. Take a moment, if you will, just take a moment, maybe just take a deep breath, too, so that you don't tire during our conference call. Take a deep breath and a moment to think about where you get your values. What inspires you deeply? Where did you get your basic sense of right and wrong? If you're a parent, as I am, you know that one of the hardest jobs we have is to pass along values to our children. You might want to jot down a note for yourself about where you got your values, where you still are inspired. And we'll just take a minute to think about that together. I'd be willing to bet that for most of us, our parents were formative in this area, maybe also our grandparents or other adult caregivers, and certainly our neighbors and others in our communities. But I would also be willing to bet that there was probably a religious institution of some sort. Maybe it was a mosque or a circle. Maybe it was a synagogue or a church or some other religious or spiritual setting, which was an important place where you, as well as I, received some very early and now deeply engraved messages about how we should live our lives, what's important, what's right, what's wrong. And even in a postmodern time when some of those categories aren't very popular, I think religions still play an important role, whether it's the Ten Commandments or marriage and burial rites, whether it's what's right and wrong in terms of ethics or how to pray or meditate. I think religions play an awfully important role in most of our lives, whether for good or for ill. And I say that coming off of a recent family event. We had a death of one of the elders in my family last week, and we all came together very quickly to a fairly distant place to go through the rites of burial that are native, as it were, to our group. And what we found was that that bonded us in ways that even went beyond how some of us feel about the Catholic Church, how we feel about its positions on women and gay rights and so forth, but it brought us together. And so I was reminded once again of the importance of religion for most of us. And what most of us want from religion are really three things, I think. First, we want community. We want people to hang out with, people with whom to bumble along, as it were. We also want ministry. If our mother is sick or our cat is caught in a tree, we want somebody to notice and do something about it. So community and ministry are two things people want from religion. And the third thing that most of us get from religion is what I call generally meaning, how the world works, how it's supposed to work. And I think community, ministry, and meaning in that order are really what religions provide for people. This is important because our religious communities are so formative in our lives, and because they're so formative, the onus upon them is enormous to be welcoming, to be inclusive of everyone. And many of our traditions have, as we have learned, have not been that way. And I speak, and I understate it now, as a Roman Catholic, I speak about questions of women's ordination, questions of abortion and reproductive justice, questions of same-sex love, that my tradition, the Catholic tradition, has been so distinguished in our society in negating. And so you could say, in a certain sense, that I specialize in these difficult issues as a theologian and as an ethicist. And WATER as an organization offers services like rituals and meditation, counseling, and educational seminars to provide feminist, religious feminists with the resources we need to bring our religious traditions to the service of social change. This has been going on for a long time. We often talk about it in general as feminist theology, that is, bringing our concern for women's well-being to the actual enterprise of naming who or what God is, naming how the world ought to work. And this was not new to our generation. In the 19th century, some of the suffrage leaders, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton, were involved in efforts to change religion as well as to change the laws so that women could vote. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and her friends formed something that they called the Revising Committee of the Bible, and they developed a project called the Women's Bible. And the story goes, and it may just be a story, but I like it anyway, the story goes that each member of the committee had two copies of the Bible and a pair of scissors. And they actually cut out those pericopes or those verses of the Bible that had to do with women. And they dealt them out to one another and said, now you write about this one, and you write about that one, and you write about the other one. And when they came back together, they weren't biblical scholars, they weren't experts in religion, they were women who had heard these texts preached for a long time, and they brought them back together and compiled them into a book called the Women's Bible. And that was a part of the very early beginnings of women finding, at least in the Christian tradition, finding their voices in terms of saying new things about religion. And we at WATER have just published a new book called New Feminist Christianity, in which we've tried to do the same thing. So if you think about what's happening in your tradition, I hope it spells change for greater inclusion of women, for ways that religion can be more useful. I find the work of Marie Fortune useful in this because her Faith Trust Institute, about 3 years ago, published a declaration by religious and spiritual leaders to address violence against women. And I'm sure many of you are aware of that declaration, but if you're not, I urge you to look it up. And what they found was that they invited leaders from spiritual and religious traditions to join them in saying that our traditions could both be used to perpetuate and condone abuse, but could also be sources for bringing about safe and violence-free zones. And so I'm happy to say that we of the progressive Catholic women signed on to this, but none of the leaders of Catholicism did. This leads to my second point, and that is the relationship between religion and other cultural influences. I think it's important to underscore that religion is not sacrosanct, that it has enormous political impact. You see this all the time in the current election cycle. Recently, one of the Tea Party candidates was questioning the issue of church and the separation of church and state. She didn't seem to realize that it was part of our Constitution. And it's hard to figure out how the separation of religion and politics works in this country. Let me give you one example. There's a lot of religious influence on politics on questions of health care. When the recent health care bill was passed, the Catholic bishops opposed it because they had the mistaken notion that the bill would cover abortion. But the Catholic Hospital Association and Network, which is a social justice lobby, said no, in fact, that wasn't the case. So lots of Catholic nuns led the charge to invite people to favor and to sign and to vote for the health care legislation. This shows you the complexity of religion, too, that on the one side, the nuns were seen as players, were only bishops and cardinals had been seen as players before. The nuns opposed them. But on the other side, I couldn't help but notice that even the nuns were not pushing for care for reproductive health coverage in health care. So you can see how complex this is, that even efforts for women to be religious agents, to name things on their own terms, can also have a negative consequence. And in this case, it certainly did. in terms of not having health care coverage that includes coverage for abortion. But my conclusion is that religion is only one influence, but it's an important one that's complicated and fraught like everything else, but it's an important part of culture. And that's why we at Water and many colleagues, for example, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, the Women's Desk of the National Council of Churches, an interfaith group in Syracuse, New York, of Women Transcending Boundaries, we're always at work on these issues. We're at work on the ordination of women, which is still prohibited, not only for Roman Catholics, but for Missouri Synod Lutherans and for Orthodox Jews, because we understand that religious discrimination means that women are not eligible not only for religiously related jobs, but in secular jobs that require ordination. So it begins to you begin to see how there's a spillover impact. Likewise, on the case of abortion, which we won't go into in depth today, but as you can imagine, the major anti-abortion case, including major funding, comes from religious people, especially Catholics, and from some smaller conservative religious groups, working at every level, legislative, medical, educational, that is, abstinence programs in schools, not to mention on the religious front, to try to overturn Roe versus Wade, and if not, to chip away state by state at women's right to choose. So abortion has been the primary place, I think, where feminists and others in religion have come to see things differently. There's a similar story on same-sex marriage. Any one of these would be a great case study for our discussion, but today I'm trying to give you a kind of big picture. I'd be happy to fill it in later. But marriage, of course, is primarily a civil matter. It's a contract between two people. In lots of countries, legal marriage is completely separate from a religious ceremony. But for some odd historical reasons here, we allow priests and ministers and rabbis and others to serve as agents of the state and perform these ceremonies. I personally don't pay taxes so as to support discrimination. So no matter what one thinks of same-sex people marrying, there's still a legal matter here which is not trivial in terms of those who are agents of the state carrying out discriminatory activities. You'll remember Proposition 8 in California, which was a ballot proposition and a state constitutional amendment declaring legal marriage in California as only between a man and a woman. But this Proposition 8 was bought and paid for by a coalition of Catholic voters in numbers and Mormon voters' money. The same thing is happening in Minnesota right now, where the Archbishop of Minneapolis and St. Paul has recently sent a DVD to all Catholic households telling them to support a call for ballot initiatives to keep marriage between a man and a woman there. I and many other Catholics have argued that the gender constellation of the persons involved is not what makes a marriage, but love, commitment, and a legal bond is what does make the legal marriage. Nonetheless, the important point is that no single religion can legislate for the country. Religions can lobby, and virtually every major religious group has a lobby group here in Washington as well as at the state level. But even the most conservative cardinals and rabbis only get one vote each when it comes to the way our system works. I would conclude by saying that religion is important to people, as we learned in my first point, and that religion is an important factor in culture, that it has political implications. And because of that, it's doubly important that it be used for the good. And that's why so many theologians, ministers, and other religious leaders, like myself, take public stands in favor of women's rights, in favor of reproductive justice, in favor of same-sex marriage from equally committed religious stances. And we do so. For example, this week there's been a major issue, a major statement sent out against bullying of young gay people. And I believe there are equally compelling arguments made on the side of those who would include and those who would eradicate violence as there are on the side of those who would exclude and who would be in favor of violence. Let me stop there, and when we have some time for questions, we'll get a sense if we're all on the same page here, not agreeing with each other, but at least understanding what I'm trying to say, and then we'll move on to my other two points of religious pluralism and the need to hold religious professionals to a high standard.
Thank you very much, Mary. Now we have an opportunity to ask questions. As April was saying before, in order to ask a question, just press star 1 on your telephone, and it will automatically put you into a queue, and then the operator will send people forward to us who come through on the question queue. So any questions, any comments, any thoughts at all that I'm sure some of you must have on this issue, directly related to what Mary has said, or just general thoughts that you have on the issue?
Amanda, can you hear me?
Yes, Ellen.
I'm trying to do a question in the question queue, but it's not going through.
Well, go right ahead.
Okay. My name's Ellen, and I'm wondering, it might not sound so connected to what you're saying, but I am thinking of it from what you're saying, is that when you're working with women where religion is both a form, it's both a source of, potentially has the seeds of her freedom and at the same time her oppression, so women are in violent relationships where religion is being used to keep her there or to make her feel guilty about not being good enough, all of those kind of things, and it's her very link to her religion that's actually in some ways keeping her in a very, very dangerous situation. But then at the same time, how do you work with religion when it plays such dual roles in women's lives that it's also the source of so much strength for women who are trying to change that that situation? And so many women that we meet might be really angry at God or at the way religion's been, used against her, but at the same time they're hanging on to it and rejecting it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, Ellen, thank you. That's a very important point. I think that's in some ways the most common experience, and that's what I was trying to get at by saying how important religion is to us and therefore the importance of it being inclusive and therefore the work that we do in terms of our social change. Because if you take, again, and I will stick with the Christian tradition, which I know best, but there are many other examples that other people can bring to us from tribal religions, from native groups, also from Judaism, Hinduism, and so forth. But it's clear that the way in which religion, and again, I'll stick with the Christian tradition, the way in which religious texts are used is very subjective and very much dependent on the kind of background that one brings to the text. And so a text like Women Be Subject to Your Husbands, for example, in the Christian scriptures can be and is often interpreted in an extremely negative way. Women are told to be subservient, and in fact that is not necessarily a proper interpretation of the text, or if it is, then perhaps the text is problematic. And that's why feminist scholars in religion and feminist scholar activists like myself have long been raising hard questions within our own traditions to change them, because we know exactly what happens, which is that those texts are used, sometimes with the best of intentions, frankly, by more fundamentalist ministers or pastors in counseling situations that do put women in enormous jeopardy. Women are told, for example, that their marriage vows mean they have to stay with even an abusive husband. Well, that's simply not true. And someone needs to come along with equal religious authority to help women to understand that. And, of course, I want women to take on their own religious authority. But in the meantime, we need to have well-trained people. And that's why the work of the Faith Trust Institute is so important. They have begun to bring many of these issues to the fore, not only in terms of scholarship, but also in terms of seminary training, so that pastors, and I'll talk about that in our next section, what you can expect from religious professionals, that the training has to change. And people have to understand that what they were taught years ago in seminary or in theological school is simply not any longer the case.
Okay, we do now have a question in the queue, and that does come from the San Francisco Women Against Rape. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Teresa Martini with San Francisco Women Against Rape, and I don't know that I have a particular question. I would like to hear your thoughts. A couple of things that come up for me when I think about religion and sexual assault are clients who are survivors of ritual abuse, and just kind of the process of supporting a survivor who may be going through healing from ritual abuse that has occurred within a context of religion and their spirituality, and how that is just the way that traumatizes them in a couple of different ways. And then I also, the other piece is around how religion has long been a source for people who want to use solutions to assault in their communities that are outside of the criminal legal system, and just around coming up with solutions within a community in that way, and I just wanted to hear some thoughts that you might have on that.
Thank you. I'm not as clear on your second question. You might need to say a little bit more about that. But certainly on your first question, is it Teresa? Did I get your name right? Thank you very much for your question. And I think that you put your finger on a very tough problem that has been written about and certainly been worked on by religious professionals, and that is the tremendous problem of ritual abuse that initially, at least by some readings, was not taken very seriously, and I think now is seen to be and is now taken very seriously by people, such that training by here at Water and other places where feminists train, training for people in liturgy and ritual also includes attention to this question. Let me give you a very simple example of it, and that is in many religious traditions there are tactile dimensions to worship. For example, in my own Catholic tradition, there's what's called the greeting of peace or the kiss of peace. There are, in other traditions, hand-holding or dancing that includes touching. And I think that what we have found is that because so many people have been are survivors of various forms of abuse, including ritual abuse, that one needs to be very careful and request permission and couch these kinds of things that are seen as very collegial and community building, couch them very carefully in the context of people's previous experiences. And I think that's very important, and that's an expectation we ought to have of our clergy and religious professionals, that they're attuned to that reality and that they're able to bring it in a graceful way into the work that they're doing so that people are comfortable and so that continued abuse doesn't happen. I think also the question of abuse, and of course in the Catholic tradition we have had an epidemic of clergy pedophilia followed by the cover-up, which I, in some ways in my mind is equally heinous, the cover-up by religious leaders, especially bishops, of the pedophilia cases. And I think that has so eroded the confidence of people in the Catholic clergy that it will be generations before there is any kind of, and I hope, frankly, that the clergy system by that point will be gone too, but that has so eroded the confidence of people that the people are now very skeptical, because what they realize is that not only is there physical abuse, but in these cases there's also the robbing, the taking away from people, especially from children, of their right to be religious on their own terms. That when you violate a person's spirituality, their trust, their sense of what's holy, you take a dimension away from them that's even on top of, and I don't mean in any way to trivialize the physical components, but it's even on top of that, it becomes one step worse. And I think that, again, the work of people like the Faith Trust Institute folks on this on these questions has been exemplary, but I'm sad to say that the problem is way out ahead of any efforts that I know of to alleviate it. Would you, Teresa, be so kind as to spell out your second question a little bit more carefully? I'm not sure that I understood it.
So the other piece is just looking at the role that religions and institutions have played in communities around solutions to violence within communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I know historically a lot of people have gone to their church or to their temple to find solutions to violence within the family or within the community. And so I was just thinking, when people are thinking of solutions outside of the criminal system, if they don't want to access, you know, often if it's your partner, you may not want to call the police on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the role that the church, that various churches and temples and religions have played in supporting survivors with solutions to violence.
Yes, that's a very important issue, and I'm going to be talking about it shortly, and I'll say more about it shortly, but I'll say very quickly that I think it cuts both ways, and that on the one hand, I think you're right that religious organizations have played an important role in helping people to try to figure out other solutions. At the same time, I would say that, at least in my experience, many of those institutions have also played a very negative role, maybe with good intentions, but they have acted as intermediaries in places where they have no business. And I will talk shortly about what we now teach people in religious circles, which is refer, refer, refer. I do not think that the garden variety pastor or imam or rabbi is in any way, shape, or form prepared to deal with these issues. And I think sometimes they get more in the way than they help. But we can talk more about that. Does that give you a sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Other questions? Or shall we move on?
We do have an additional question that comes from Asha Kiran. Your line is open.
Thank you.
This is Bhavani from Asha Kiran. Mary, I would like to know what your thoughts on culture getting ingrained into religion and I guess in controlling or changing behaviors of mass people, whether they are rituals, you know, like you were talking about, or external behaviors such as holding hands, what you were saying, or any other means, you know. How is that influenced, and you can see the influence? I wanted to know your thoughts on it. Culture gets ingrained into the religion, and it changes as it goes on.
Yes, thank you. You're right about that. That religions are not static. They do change, and they look different in different cultures. We refer to this in religious circles as enculturation. And, of course, that's in contrast to a time when people thought that religions just sort of arrived full-blown and that Christianity, for example, looked the same in Chicago as it does in Bangkok, or it looked the same in Rome as it did in St. Croix. I mean, this is just not the case, because all of our religions are influenced deeply by the cultures in which they're set. That said, it becomes a very difficult problem to try to say anything normative about religions. At the same time, traditions do have their own limits and certain beliefs and practices. And I'm very interested in having local participation and having people say, you know, in our situation, that just doesn't work. That is not appropriate. Or this is something that really is appropriate. Or this helps us to understand our tradition better. And so I think one of the other dynamics here is that those of us who are pushing for these kinds of changes within our religious institutions are pushing not only for a change in the content of our religions, but we're also pushing for a change in what I'd call the method or the way in which the religions take shape. So, for example, in Catholicism, we're not very interested in what the Pope has to say about a lot of things, but we're very interested in what our neighbors and our friends and the people that we work on social change with have to say about things, and that's a bottom up, not a top down approach. And so that's a difference. That's a change in method, as well as a change in content. And I think it's going to take both, in order to bring religions, many religions that have been problematic in these areas, into line with how we need them to be in a culture that is increasingly violent and that needs the value systems that religions pretend to purvey. Are there
okay.
other questions? Do you want to respond to that? That may not be exactly what you're getting at, but
also, say for example, Hinduism.
Sure.
You know, if you go back to the older text, or you know, not the translations, and it has passed through many generations, there is nothing like you can't hold hands. You know, woman is inferior. You don't read any of those things,
mm-hmm.
and you know, over the time, you know, things changed. It got ingrained. The culture, whatever the traditions and culture, got ingrained into the religious activities. And it's not really a religious text where it has come from. It changed. Like, you know, the river goes through, you know, taking things along its stream. Same way religion has changed to control people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Not much of a word to say it, but I see that religions.
Right.
It's not what it was originally, and it changed by the traditional practices.
Yeah, and the tricky problem is to figure out whether what's really important is the original, quote-unquote, text or practice, or what's important is how people now make sense of it. And I think, while I think both of those are important, I think there's often been, in a more fundamentalist reading of many of our traditions, a kind of hearkening back to some pristine origins of the tradition that we really can't be sure of anymore. So I think I'd like to go on then and talk about my other two points, if I may, and then we'll open the queue again, because I think the discussion in some ways is the richest part of this. I'd like to look at two other issues here, which I think may help you with some of the work that you're doing. You might want to just take a minute to kind of shake out your hands or stand up and just give yourself a little change of position so that we can jump into these other questions, because an hour and a half is a long time for folks to be engaged. So let's just take 1 minute together and kind of shake a little bit and move our hands and if we can, and maybe stand up and sit down again and look at the two other questions I want to look at for your consideration. And the first is, how do we deal with religious diversity? This is a question that I think you will find often in your work, especially on issues of sexual and domestic violence, that there really is now not a single or even two major strands of religion in this country, but we now live in an enormously religiously diverse situation. And the person who is best equipped to talk about this is someone whose name is on your syllabus, and that is Professor Diana Eck, E-C-K. She is the U.S. expert and maybe the world's expert on religious pluralism, at least in this setting. And she has written a book in which she describes the way in which what was a primarily Christian and secondarily Jewish culture has now become the most religiously diverse country in the world. Her book, A New Religious America, which if you're interested in reading something on this topic, I highly recommend. And what I think I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about religious diversity, because she certainly, hopefully down the pike, will do that in this setting, and I think you'll be deeply enriched. But let me say two brief things about it. First, I completely agree with Diana Eck that the major change in American religion in the last 50 years has been the proliferation of religious groups, so that Christianity is no longer in the lead. It certainly has lost its hegemony, its almost exclusive hold on culture. Just think of the holidays that we still celebrate for school holidays in this country to get a sense of how much of that still remains. It's not surprising that our school vacations are conveniently placed at Christmas and Easter in most districts. But things have changed some, and at least we're beginning to get some of the Jewish holidays off. And our children are growing. I have a 9-year-old, and I have children who are grown. She's now 10, actually. I have a 10-year-old who's growing up in a very religiously diverse world, much more so than my own rather sheltered, parochial, ghettoized Catholicism in upstate New York when I was a child. Religious diversity is a rich resource in this country if we're smart and open enough to utilize it. I think to see religious diversity as a resource for both social change and for understanding the world in quite new ways is really one of the things we can take away from this conversation, and say that in the area of sexual and domestic violence, the proliferation of religious resources has not been simply out of the Christian tradition, but also from Judaism, from Hinduism, from Islam, and certainly from Native groups as well. So I think that religious pluralism is a great resource and something we want to take very seriously. Having said that, I want to go to a second point about religious pluralism or religious diversity, and that is to say that it's both internal and external. It's pretty easy to think about the fact that we're not all Catholics or Buddhists or members of Native groups. We're not all Hindus or pagans. But it's a little more tricky to think about the fact that within Native religious groups, for example, there's an enormous variety of religious understandings and religious beliefs. Likewise, in Catholicism, there's an enormous range from the Opus Dei on the right to liberation theologians on the left. So within each of our traditions, there's enormous variety or pluralism as well. If you think about the Protestant churches in this country, the Presbyterians, the Baptists, the United Church of Christ, the Lutherans, and countless others, there's such a variety both within each of those denominations and among those denominations. Think, too, of Jews who are Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionists, and so forth. The important point is to be clear when we're talking about religion what and whom we mean when we say somebody or something is religious. We also need to be clear that there are leaders in all of these subgroups. so that if you're looking, for example, for a representative of the Catholic Church, let's say somebody comes to you and she's Catholic and says, oh, gosh, I've got this situation that I really want to talk to a clergy person about, don't immediately assume that she means a male priest. Let's say she wants a religious counselor. Don't immediately assume that you have to call the parish on the corner where the priest may or may not have any idea what you're talking about. Assume that there are lots of people out there who don't necessarily wear Roman collars, who aren't necessarily part of the institutional church, but who come from her tradition or from her culture and can be helpful to her as religious professionals. And I think that's a really exciting thing to think about, but something that most of us have not gotten too far with in terms of the practical implications of it. I think, for example, when if a Jewish woman calls and she wants to talk with someone from her tradition, well, if she's Orthodox, I may not be able to find her a rabbi who's going to be sympathetic. But if I think about the JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, I can probably find somebody there who will speak her language, who will understand from heart to heart what she means and will be helpful to her, even though that person will not be an ordained Orthodox rabbi. I think this is awfully important to begin to think about so that we expand our own horizons about what it means to be religious, that pluralism is not just among different faiths, but also within each of our own traditions, there's enormous pluralism. And to begin to take seriously and to name as leaders people who aren't necessarily part of those institutions. And I have to say that this leads to my let me give two examples of that first, and then I'll go to my last point, which is what we expect of religious professionals. I'm thinking, for example, on the contentious issues of same-sex love, and that the institutional religious organizations have not been terribly helpful for the most part. But there is a group called the National Religious Leadership Roundtable, which is a project of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, which brings together, much as some of your national domestic violence groups come together, these groups come together as leaders of gay and lesbian leaders from queer, transgender, bisexual leaders of different religious traditions and bring together those folks from a variety of traditions on a regular basis for networking, for alliance building, and for education. And I think that's a resource that one can think about as an interreligious example of where we're moving, so that it's not simply pluralism as an abstract idea, but concretely in the work of groups like that. Another group is the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, which is a grouping of organizations from a variety of traditions, Christian, Jewish, and other, that work on issues of reproductive justice. So there's some real concrete religious diversity, pluralism being done on the ground that's a resource for folks like you. And this leads to my last point, and then we'll open the phones again. What do we expect of religious professionals these days? Well, once again, I turn to the Faith Trust Institute as a model of what religious professionals can and should be about. I think of Marie Fortune, who is ordained as a United Church of Christ minister, who's well-respected, pastorally savvy, and theopolitically on target. She and her colleagues are why the issues so close to your hearts, the issues of sexual and domestic violence, are now on the radar of so many religious professionals. It used to be that the clergy or religious leaders or tribal elders were the most highly educated people in a community, but that's no longer the case in most places. Religious leaders should do what they're good at, education, preaching, worship, officiating at events like marriages and funerals, but not be expected in our very complex time to be jacks or jills of all trades. I think that's an important thing that we also have to remember so that we don't look to them for something that they're really constitutionally unable to do. And that's why in the second instance, I think clergy and religious professionals now need to refer on issues on which they're not competent. And that's surely true of sexual and domestic violence. I would say it's also true on many issues of for example, counseling same-sex couples, on many instances of reproductive justice, health decisions. I think many of our clergy and religious professionals are simply not competent to do the kind of work that we sometimes ask them to do, and they often do more damage in the name of God than of a God that I don't recognize. Well, to give them their due at the same time, my third sub-point here would be to say that we can count on some of our religious leaders for social and cultural leadership. As I mentioned earlier, there's currently a very good open statement being circulated among religious professionals. It's a groundbreaking alliance of high-level mainline leaders of faith groups that are dealing with bullying, and we have seen these terrible instances of bullying that have led to suicides and deaths of young people in recent days. So in local communities, I think we have to take great care in deciding which clergy and religious professionals we will consult, with whom we'll work, especially if they're iffy on the important issues that you folks are dealing with. But at the same time, there are plenty of people to work with, not admittedly in every local area, but that's why the internet and alliances are so important, so that you can get the kind of pastoral care and religious leadership that you deserve. Settling for nothing less and knowing that those of us who work on these issues from the side of religion are doing our best to raise the general level of competence through education, and we're trying to change some of the most oppressive ways in which mainstream patriarchal religions have functioned in order to replace them with vibrant, women-affirming, diverse religious groups that can set the pace for social change and communal justice. So those two points, namely the importance and the proliferation of religious diversity and the interfaith efforts that are going on many of these issues, including, as I said, gay and lesbian issues and reproductive health, and then high expectations of religious professionals and helping them to realize where they can and can't be helpful, I think help to round out this question of spirituality and social change. With that, I will stop my comments for the moment and hopefully take your comments and questions. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to share a conversation with you, and I hope that we'll have more such opportunities. You can always contact me at either at www.hers.com/water or simply at the email water@hers.com, hers meaning belonging to her, water@hers.com. And I'm happy to be helpful to you on an individual basis as well as in this call. So shall we open the phones and continue our discussion?
Okay, we do have a few guests in the queue at this time.
Okay, good.
And first we do have the Monsoon United Nation of Iowa. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Lata from Monsoon.
Hi, Lata. How are you doing?
Welcome.
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm pretty
Amanda?
Good. It's nice to hear your voice again.
Same here. Thank you. Can you all hear me clearly?
Yes,
thank you, Monsoon. Go ahead.
Okay. And this is for Mary, and I'm not sure if you're going to address it. I just want to say that I was born and raised Catholic, but I call myself atheist. I have had no problems at all with so far with survivors I talk to or provide advocacy for. But I was wondering what your thoughts on advocates who were atheists, who had I don't even want to use the word spirituality because I immediately think that people think it's religious.
Mm-hmm.
My sense of ethics possibly came from, as you said, religion in a sense, and then, of course, it was developed in different ways as I grew up. So I have a problem when, everyone starts to tell me about how religions are fair, which I know is not true. I know religious texts don't say that regardless of how we interpret them. And as you also did indicate, there must be a problem also with the religious texts. I know someone mentioned something about the Hindu tradition, and if you see some of the scripts, the Manusmriti, for instance, that does not say anything about religious equality, about gender equality. But my question was, I wanted to know if you were going to talk about atheists or that was not going to be part of your discussion.
Well, I first of all, thank you for joining in the conversation and raising the question. I assume that the issue that I'm addressing is how religion, for those who are religious, functions. But I don't in any way assume that everybody is, nor that everybody should be. So I would include, but I think the question is really not so much the faith tradition of the service provider, but the way in which any service provider would interface with people who do have a religious tradition. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely.
I don't think it has to do. I don't think the faith, like it isn't really important whether I'm an atheist or a believer. It's if I'm providing care, pastoral care, or legal counsel, or safety and protection for people, that I understand enough about where they're coming from in terms of their religious understanding or lack of it. And that goes to the other side of your question, which is, of course, many of our survivors will also not have any religious practice, and so what could be worse than imposing some upon them? But no, I'm not leaving out atheism as a legitimate and important and integral way of being in of understanding oneself in the world. But I think the question is, what do we do with, even if we are atheists ourselves, or agnostics even, what do we do in the face of people who come to us and whose issues or problems or choices are deeply determined by their own religious traditions? And that's what I'm interested in, that we have some tools and some ways to understand what's going on. And one of them is to say that one need not be religious to be a good person. One need not be a believer to lead a virtuous life. And I think those kinds of things need to be said loudly and clearly. And if your question gives me the opportunity to do that, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you. It was absolutely what I because I agree with you, and I do appreciate you when you said that if, and I have done it a couple of times when, you know, survivors have asked for a certain religious community, religious leader to be able to talk to them, and I've been able to refer them to them because I would not be able to provide that kind of service. But yes, thank you for your answer.
You're welcome, and thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Next, we do have WSCADV. Your line is now open.
Oh, hi. Mary, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, great, great. My name
What's
is Tira. It's Tira.
Tira, hi.
Hi. So I've been listening. This is great. This is a topic that just is near to my heart. The issue of religion. So I just had a couple of things that I wanted to say. First of all, it was about the refer thing that you said. You know, I've been an advocate for decades, and that was my mantra to everyone I talked to, whether it was whatever area that people were working in, was refer. And I have really rethought that recently.
Oh, tell us about that. Great.
Because you can't, so what you started out even in your talk about the main three things that people provide within religious context are community, ministry, and meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what people go there. People who do engage in religion go there for those things. And you cannot, and putting domestic violence and sexual assault within the context of a meaning in someone's life is perfectly within the purview of all religious all religions and all religious people, whether they actually are able to do that or not. So you can't actually refer. I mean, part of my concern about the refer now is send somebody off and turn your back on them, even within the context of what it is that you're trying to help them with. And so I just feel like it's really easy for people to say, well, I sent so-and-so off to the shelter, and so I can, you know, clap my hands together and be done with it. But what that person needs within the context of, for example, their religious institution is community, ministry in terms of, whatever questions they have about being a member of their community, as well as theological questions about whatever religion they belong to, and they need to make meaning of it. And so one of my concerns about advising religious folks to refer is I just don't think it's good advice. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes perfect sense. And I think we have to probably talk longer than we have this afternoon to really tease out some of the nuances on both sides of the argument. But I think that what you're getting at is a very salient issue, and that is the legitimate place of religion and of religious leaders in the movement. And that's, again, I keep going back to Faith Trust. I think they're the experts on this. I think Marie Fortune could give you countless examples of ways in which this works. But at the same time, I think they would be among the first to say that the garden variety religious professional, now I'm not talking about you or other people who are skilled in this, but the garden variety religious professional who has gone through seminary or some kind of theological training or not, that the person that most women, I'm going to be very restricted in my example, that most women would find as the first line of somebody that would provide them with pastoral counseling in their local situation. And again, I'm going to limit it now to the Christian churches, and I know that this is a limited sample. But I think most people would find that person would probably not be equipped to handle things in a way that would be even safe for a lot of women. Let me give you does that make sense to you?
Well, right.
I mean, and what I want to do is go through the whole thing, because I think what happens is it's not refer is not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the story. And once a survivor, especially someone who's in immediate danger, gets the kind of safety and help that they need, then I completely concur with you that it is absolutely essential that religious professionals take on providing the kind of community in which a survivor can feel some degree of safety, provide the kind of ministry that accompanies a survivor through all of the process, legal, physical, et cetera, and certainly that takes on the task within a particular religious tradition of trying to make meaning of a very difficult situation. And that's where I think we come together on this. But I don't think that it's a question of washing one's hands and saying, oh, I'm finished, now it's gone. But honestly speaking, when I look at people that I see in the religious profession, I wouldn't want my sister in the hands of most of them if they weren't going to send her to get other help and then maybe go back. And that also takes the question of meaning to a new level too, because things like, for example, the whole question of forgiveness in the issue of sexual and domestic violence is a central theme that many of us have been working on for years and years and years. And only now is it beginning to dawn on many, and again, the garden variety religious professional, that maybe forgiveness, and especially in the Christian tradition, is not something that happens automatically. It is not something that one ought to be counseled to forgive and forget. But maybe you wouldn't, but I think some people would be shocked to think of the number of religious professionals, again, especially in the Christian tradition that I want to speak about most specifically, because I don't want to venture into air. I wouldn't want to insult people in other traditions that I didn't know enough about. But you would be surprised at the number of, maybe not, at the number of people who would still be handing out, well, you should forgive him, go back, give him another chance, try it again, absolutely putting the woman in harm's way.
Right.
And
well, I totally understand that, but I also think that there are large groups of people for whom they're not going to take you up on a referral. The religious organization is pretty much who they trust and where they go and where their community is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like it's naive of us as advocates to imagine that we're just going to go to a, for example, in a immigrant community where people are undocumented or whatever, you know, to go and say, you know, refer them to us because we'll refer them to the police and blah, blah, blah. I mean, people are just not going to go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us to not say that really our challenge as advocates is to figure out how to work within the religious community that people are in to make it as good as it possibly can be around even this issue of forgiveness or, you know, whatever. I mean,
well,
forgiveness is kind of, forgiveness is pretty far out there, actually. I mean, even the issue of whatever accountability or controls a religious leader could have of a perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever, I mean, if there is, in fact, authority or power there that a religious leader has over somebody address it, or I almost want to say fix it, but that's not it either. But.
Yes, and that absolutely would be something that the Faith Trust people would want to have happen, and that's what they and we and others working on these issues are trying to do all the time.
Yeah.
But we're also realistic enough to know what's out there. And, I wish you were right in terms of how religious professionals can be helpful. My experience in the cases that I've seen and heard and been involved in, so often the religious professionals themselves don't have a clue about appropriate boundaries. they don't have a clue about how serious these situations are in terms of women's safety. And what you end up with is, more often than not, people who cause greater harm than good. And that's why one of the prongs of the many pronged approach to this in religion is to try to get into the curriculum of theological education so that future people in those positions will have much more by way of resources to work with. But at the moment, I would lie to you to say I were confident that most of them could handle what we're dealing with here.
Right.
But I so appreciate you raising it. Let's go to another person.
Mary,
and then we'll...
thank you very much.
Sure.
Mary, this is Amanda. I think you're bringing up a really interesting thing, but I think from the perspective of kind of local advocates in communities, and those communities, you know, are massively diverse. They range from, you know, people working in extremely remote areas, people working in urban areas, people working within, you know, specific communities or specific identities, and each of those communities have different relationships to church and religion. But in general, I think what you're saying is that that for the local advocate, there's this, in working with clerics or religious representatives or whoever they are, you're getting this balance between what I would call the social change work, the change work within the community, the change work of what the local church is doing, or the local church representatives are doing on the issue, versus what happens on individual women's situations and how it is that they handle those particular situations, that both those things can have to be sort of taken into account. Because when you say refer, you're not saying just abandon them to what their current thinking is on the issue.
No, to the contrary. I'm suggesting that refer is what those religious professionals who encounter a survivor who need the work, who need the support of the advocates who are part of this call, it's they're the people to whom the clergy and religious leaders ought to refer. And that is by no means abandoning them, but in fact putting them in the hands of people who do have the kinds of resources and are getting this kind of training to know what to do. That's the point I'm making. And I think, for example, if I live in an area, the local Catholic parish is mostly Hispanic, and if I were a woman in that parish, and I don't even know the pastor, but I can't imagine that he would be equipped to deal with my situation if I were in a context of being abused in my home. I can't imagine that he would have the first clue what to say about that situation, especially if my partner were a woman.
So the local advocate's dilemma is, on the one hand, right now they're not equipped. But on the other hand, the long-term strategy is to have them be eventually well enough equipped to be able to do the things that Tara mentioned, you mentioned, the ministry, the community, and everything else. That's the long-term goal of advocacy, would be to make it so that when women do go to that church, they do get the right kind of support plus the referral.
Yes, I think
not
that's right. I think it's clearly a both-and situation, and I don't mean to, and maybe I misspoke myself by not nuancing my comment more, but I do think it's a both-and situation, and that this is where we come together, and this is where the kind of work that is part of your program and the kind of work that we do and Faith Trust and others do is really so critical, that much of it is being done, and even the scholarly work has been done, but it hasn't trickled down by any means to the people who need it most on the ground. Shall we go to another question, Amanda? Is that clarified?
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
Is that good, Tara? Okay. Operator, bring us to another question. That's good.
Okay. Our next question comes from the Hope and Justice Project. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Francine Stark. I really appreciate you speaking, Mary. I wanted to share a little piece with folks because starting in 1994, I was co-teaching a class at the Bangor Theological Seminary with Reverend Dr. Marvin Ellison.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah, he's wonderful. And we have taught this class on theological perspectives on domestic violence and sexual assault for a number of years. And I think I would share with people that, you know, he's an extraordinary partner. I would imagine in other states and areas there are people open. He's primarily an ethics professor at the seminary. What we were able to do in this class was to bring people from the community, practicing clergy and clergy in training, to really spend a whole semester on talking about these issues and really having thoughtful dialogue around them. I think perhaps one of the things that the students appreciated the most was to see me as an advocate sitting beside Marvin as a clergy person and the different frameworks that we spoke from around these issues, and for them to all recognize the complementary nature of our work and the importance of both of our work being together. So that it refer, refer, refer was the theme, but that we should be referring back and forth, and what our distinct roles were and what our common goals were together. And it was really helpful when we had conversation about things like forgiveness and divorce and all these other choices to bring my very different point of view and different spiritual perspective into that room. And I'll say one of the most exciting things that came out of it was a woman 1 year who shared, she's now an ordained Episcopal clergy person, and has been writing essays about her experience as a survivor of domestic violence and how coming into that class really helped her frame her experience and her writings that she's just been doing tremendous outreach with and participating in a local task force. And I think engaging with the seminary in that way helped me really recognize how religion in its diversity is part of our coordinated community response. And if we aren't prepared to talk to women about what their religion means to them in their process, then we're leaving out an enormous part of what will make them, in fact, safe in the long term.
Francine, that's very insightful and I think very well chosen example. I know Marvin Ellison personally, and I can only underscore what you said about his leadership, and I'm sure your own in the situation, and I would be confident that you provided a kind of model that many, many other training programs in both in religion and in advocacy need. So I appreciate your laying that out. I also would be confident that the students who came out of that class now practice ministry very differently, and I think that the point that you make about the mutual referring is very helpful in terms of our earlier conversation. I also think the point that you make about the importance of religion as a cultural factor is critical, and it goes back to the question about atheism, that it really doesn't matter, with all due respect, it doesn't matter what religious tradition I come from. What matters is that I'm able to hear and to understand and to somehow interface with the religious tradition of the person with whom I'm in conversation. And I think that's where this kind of religious pluralism and an understanding of what religions teach and what they don't teach. Because a lot of times when we say, oh, well, it's, you know, the Catholicism teaches this. Well, no, what kind of Catholicism teaches that? This is a Hindu belief. Well, what kind of a Hindu belief is it? Oh, well, this comes from Judaism. Well, what sector of Judaism really believes that? So I think we have to bring this kind of critical apparatus all the way across the board. And I appreciate, Francine, very much your laying out this example. Thank you.
Yes, our next question does come from SFWAR. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Julie from San Francisco Women Against Rape. My question was, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about 10 minutes ago, sorry. it's basically reiterating, kind of supporting what Mary had said about the and both kind of situation, you know, like referring, but then also supporting within the religious community at the same time. Because what I was just thinking was that, you know, it's Mary has kind of said a lot of this already, but just the training that advocates have is very specific, and I'm thinking that, you know, for clergy, it's probably more general, and I'm thinking that with, you know, in within a religious community, there's so many different issues that come up that they have to be responsive to, that, you know, I would think the and both approach would be really great, because you have the really specific training of the advocates, you know, and then also the spiritual leadership that can provide that kind of support as well. So that's all.
Thank you. I'd like to make a couple of concluding remarks, and then I think there will be a chance for concluding questions or comments from our leaders and also from our participants. First of all, I want to reiterate my gratitude to all of you for being part of this. I have certainly learned and profited from it myself, so thank you so very much. I'd like to just rehearse those four issues that I talked about, and maybe in light of our subsequent conversations, state them a little bit differently. The first is the centrality of religion and spirituality in many people's lives. And I think what our conversation at least has helped me to see is that continues to be true. And I think it's also important to say that those of us who work at the change of those traditions do it not because we hate our traditions or because we want to leave them, but because we love them so much that we want to see them be better. We want to see them passed on to our children in ways that are useful. Secondly, the question of the relationship between religion and other cultural influences. And here we had a couple of comments, especially on the question of how other aspects of culture influence religion. And I think it's safe to say that religions are not innocent, that they have direct political implications, so that it's doubly important that we be diverse and welcoming and just within our religious traditions, if in fact those are messages we intend to give out from our religious traditions. The third issue I touched on was that of religious diversity, both the diversity among religious traditions and the diversity within a particular religious tradition. And here I tried to say, and I think our conversation proves it, that religions can be a real resource for change and for enrichment. When I think back to that statement from the Faith Trust Institute, and I urge you to take a look at it, they say, we proclaim with one voice as national spiritual and religious leaders that violence against women exists in all communities, including our own, and is morally, spiritually, and universally intolerable. I just think that's such a strong statement, and I can't think of any other group of people who could make it than religious and spiritual leaders. And I suspect those who are humanists or atheists or agnostics might find themselves in that as well, that they also speak in the same voice, saying that violence against women exists everywhere, and it is morally, spiritually, and universally intolerable. And finally, the question of what to expect of religious professionals. I think we've had some good conversation here about how it really runs the gamut, that you have people who are extremely well-positioned, like a Marvin Ellison, to be a real partner in this work, and you have others who simply don't have a clue about how to do it. And so somewhere in that range, we have to find ourselves and still hold out for, as I said earlier, expecting and needing the highest professional work. And if I could leave you just with a sort of vision around this, my vision for this really has three components. One is that our children would, children like mine, would get the kind of religion at home and in public life that would see that religious diversity is normative and wonderful. Second, that religious leaders would be in the forefront of social justice movements, especially on violence against women and children, as they were in the civil rights movement, as some of them were in the anti-war movements of the 1960s, and as others have been in the gay rights movement, that religious leaders would really see themselves as taking on violence against women and children as a major part of their own ministry. And finally, that religious views of all kinds, that religious views across the board, would try to develop what is best about the human community and about the planetary community, and would develop that vision, those religious visions, with a notion that there's plenty to share for all. So with those comments, I conclude my input and thank you again for inviting me and wish you very well on the rest of your course.
I want to ask you a couple of questions, and while I'm doing that, then just to sort of finish up, but while I'm doing that, if any of you participants out there want to come in with a final comment, then please do so. So just press star 1 on the phone, and if I can ask the operator, just interrupt me as soon as we've got anybody who comes on the line.
And let me just say once again that people can feel free to contact me at water@hers.com or go to our website, the Women's Alliance for Theology, Ethics, and Ritual. I'd be happy to talk with people individually or to communicate with them if that would be helpful. Go ahead.
Okay, great. Yeah. So I guess the question that I have is that when you say religion isn't innocent or it isn't neutral, it isn't specifically in relation to this issue of violence against women. It isn't that when we're struggling with dealing with local, national, whatever, religious doctrine, the way that you talk about it and the way you think is not the dominant ideology, let's say.
You noticed, Sandy, huh?
Yeah, right. How is it that local advocates can draw more upon the sort of alternate views about religion so that they have it more as a resource, and but also, you know, how is it that they can generate more of that in their kind of local communities?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's specific examples that you've seen, obviously you've talked a lot about the Faith Trust Institute and what they're doing, but just from your own experience, if there's things that you mm-hmm. think, well, what is it that brings this way of thinking about religion more kind of to the fore and makes it have more power in our cultures and in our society?
Yeah. First of all, it's true that my approach to religion, just as perhaps your approach to questions of violence, would not be normative, quote-unquote, mainstream, quote-unquote. That's why we do the work that we do, because what's normative and mainstream is dangerous for women and children and is simply not adequate to the needs of our time. And so I think the question is, how do we put people in touch with resources in their own community that are alternative views or new views within their own traditions? And here, I think the PR problem is on our side, that there are groups like Water and Faith Trust and others that are doing this work, but it's hard to get the word out. I know in many, many, even small towns and rural areas, there are people who are connecting, whether through the internet or through a local coffee shop, with people who have different views. Maybe they're hanging out at the local Unitarian Universalist church. I can't say specifically, but I think that one of the things to do is to get out of the mindset that what is religious is what religious institutions look like, and to realize that everyone has the right and the responsibility to name their own questions of ultimate meaning and value and the things that are most motivating and inspiring to them, and that's not something to be left to religious professionals, but something to be encouraged. And I think it's of a piece with the tolerance of violence in our society that many people, and especially women, don't think themselves worthy or don't think themselves competent to name those things for themselves, and I think that has to be part of our work as well. What do you think? How do you experience it? Not what did someone in authority tell you? And that's a tricky problem, especially when, at the same time, as someone said earlier, we also have to find, quote-unquote, religious professionals who are seen as authorities who can institute new content. So we've kind of got a three-dimensional tic-tac-toe problem on our hands here. But I have found that local women's groups, local women's centers, local spiritual circles are also places where a lot of folks who think the way I do can be found. We're also publishing lots of things. There are plenty of books and resources. Go to our website and others and find these groups, for example, among Catholics. There's a women church movement, women-church movement, which is not a church for women, but it's a way for women to be protagonists of their own spirituality. That's going on in lots of different traditions. JOFA, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance that I talked about, is a remarkable organization of Orthodox women who are trying to develop things on their own terms. Now, that's quite a step out there. Does that begin to get at your question, Sandy?
Amanda, yeah.
Amanda. Yeah.
That's fine, yeah. No, I think that's a great way to close. We don't have any other points. People waiting to make a point, do we, operator?
Actually, we do just have one additional guest.
Oh, let's get that one last one in.
And that's a follow-up, looks like, from the San Francisco Women Against Rape. Your line is open.
Okay, you're going to get the last word, San Francisco.
Sorry, thanks. I just wanted to put out there real quick, because I'm the director of the volunteer program here as well, that it's also important in this process to really be considerate when doing trainings to teach people to do crisis counseling and when holding events for organizations, to make sure that we are considering the religious holidays and the holy days of a variety of religions, so that we can have a diverse pool of people in our organizations representing a wide range of religions, so that we can also be providing peer counselors for people of a variety of religions if they want someone from that religious practice.
Great point.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. All right, well, thank you very much to you, Dr. Hunt. We really appreciate your being on the call and sharing your all your knowledge and experience with us. It's been a great opportunity for us.
And looking ahead, please join us. We will be having our Affinity Group of Advocates call on Wednesday, November 3rd, and Affinity Group of Managers call on Thursday, November 4th. Also, we will be having our audio conference training for advocates Tuesday, November 9th, and our audio conference training for managers on Thursday, November 11th. Publicity will be sent out regarding these events in the upcoming weeks.
Okay, thank you, April. Okay, goodbye, everyone. Take care of yourselves. We'll talk to you again either on the affinity calls or in a few weeks on the advocacy or the manager training. We look forward to having you all together again, and thank you again, Dr. Hunt.
My pleasure.
Goodbye,
thank
everyone.
You. Best wishes.